The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Great to be with you. This week, the Supreme Court goes back to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and does a major revision.
If sex is no longer tied to biology, that is a seismic shift in our society.
Conservatives and originalists were more than a little disappointed, and they were puzzled.
Justice Gorsuch, meet Justice Gorsuch.
And amidst the civil unrest and Black Lives Matter, a leading black conservative is out with a documentary pressing a counter-argument hard. We'll talk to Larry Elder about the film Uncle Tom.
If we had a vaccine to get rid of anti-black racism, let's say every bit of it is purged from every heart of America, are the principal problems facing the black community still there? Will 70% of black kids still be raised without fathers?
We have all this and more. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. You can catch my program live each weekday afternoon on WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. If you're a regular listener to this program or my own program on WAVA in Washington, D.C., you've likely heard some of our coverage of the key cases before the Supreme Court this term. Among them, the Harris Funeral Home case, which was combined with two other cases in a challenge to the meaning of the word sex in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. With civil unrest and a pandemic dominating the news cycle, the decision on June 15th came as quite a surprise and quite a disappointment. I turned to Kate Anderson of Alliance Defending Freedom.
If sex is no longer tied to biology, that is a seismic shift in our society.
Now, the surprise was that Gorsuch and I believe Roberts also voted, both expected to be conservative, especially on issues like this. What happened?
Well, it's surprising that any of the justices would make this move. Yeah. The laws are interpreted by the courts. They are changed by Congress, and there's an important reason for that separation of power. Congress is the one that's able to look at the consequences of changes in the law and how they will impact businesses, employees, free speech, women's rights and equal opportunities, and the court is ill-equipped to do that. So it's concerning to see that kind of move from any of the justices.
There was a case, is a case, that your organization's involved with. We've talked about it in the earlier stages as well, and that's one, RG and GR Harris Funeral Homes, a fifth-generation family business.
We represented GR and RG Harris Funeral Homes. They had a male funeral director who worked with them for over 6 years. They had a sex-specific dress code that was in accord with federal law and the guidance from the agency that actually deals with Title VII and employment issues. And after 6 years, that employee came to them and indicated that the employee intended to begin dressing as a woman while working with grieving families. Certainly, the owner took some time to think about how this could work, was concerned about the impact on this employee, on his other employees, as well as how it would impact his families that he served. The sex-specific dress code was muted and professional and designed to help families focus entirely on themselves. And so he decided that he could not go along with this employee's plan. Unfortunately, this became a test case for both the federal agency dealing with these issues and the ACLU to try to push this agenda to change sex in federal law to mean gender identity.
Now, what other implications might this have for longer term churches, let's say, other religious institutions?
Absolutely. This is a law that deals with federal employment law. So the decision was specific to Title VII. And that particular law has an exemption for religious organizations. So that provides some limited protection at this point. But many other local laws that make these kinds of changes, as well as other federal laws, look to Title VII to determine how they should interpret and apply their laws. So it's only one short step until this is being applied in areas where churches do not have an exemption. And certainly there are ramifications for Christian business owners and how they're going to operate and the decisions that they're going to make about their business, as well as we're very concerned about the impact on women. These federal laws have been in place to ensure equal opportunities for women. And when you divorce the idea of biology from sex, this really hurts women's abilities to compete in athletics, women's privacy issues involving women's shelters and who can access them and who can work at them. Those kinds of things are all now at play.
Now, is it a fait accompli, Kate, at this point, the only recourse being to go to Congress and have a new law written that really takes back control of this issue legislatively from the high court, which it overstepped itself in doing, or what?
There are certainly legislative options here. There are still good arguments to make in courts, especially as these apply to other laws. There are reasons why men and women are different and why that's important in the sports context, in the privacy context, even in the employment context, when it actually is a part of the qualifications for the job, such as in women's prisons or women's shelters. So there are still some good arguments to be made there, and we will continue to work to try to make sure that these equal opportunities for women stay in place and that Christian business owners are treated with respect and dignity that they deserve as well.
How hopeful are you that, in fact, these issues can be reversed?
I'm hopeful that in the next coming round of cases on these issues, we see a greater respect for differences of opinion, and we see society start to understand again that the Christian viewpoint on these things is important. But that only happens if believers go out and educate their community and stand by their beliefs.
One of the key triumphs for the conservative cause from the Trump administration has been the appointment of judges. Judges who would interpret the law and uphold the Constitution. To date, President Trump has appointed nearly 200 men and women to federal judgeships. And as a pattern, those judges have received some very high marks. Which raises the question, what happened here? For analysis, we'll turn now to Albert Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and a member of the Salem Editorial Board. He joined Bill Bunkley on Faith Talk WTBN in Tampa.
Homosexual rights have become part of the Civil Rights Code. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Bill, it's a pretty disastrous decision in my view, not just because of the result which furthers the moral revolution, but because of the usurpation once again of the political system by the court. And in this case, with the supposedly conservative Chief Justice and Justice Neil Gorsuch very much a part of it. Justice Alito has it exactly right. Whatever it is not a judicial opinion. It's legislation. And, Bill, I have to tell you, I was just looking at some of the writings of Justice Neil Gorsuch, and I just wish that he remembered what he had written years ago, because he was right then and he's wrong now.
How widespread is this? Does it apply to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and its hiring? Does it apply to 501c3 ministries? And, of course, the big one, how about churches themselves? Have you had a chance to sort of dive into any of those implications?
Yeah, two things I want to say about that, Bill. First of all, when you look at the actual decision, it's clear that the majority understood that there would be further issues related to how far-reaching its decision will be. But it will immediately lead to Title IX claims, which means that any religious institution taking Title IX funds, like a Christian college, will be facing these claims. And so the court's majority is trying to argue that this was a rather narrow decision, but of course it's not, as even they acknowledge, it's going to open the floodgates of litigation. It's an extremely reckless decision, and one that could have been entirely avoided, and one, frankly, that's just intellectually dishonest. No honest person, and that includes the majority of the court, can say that the word sex in 1964 or in 1972 meant sexual orientation. They concede that, but then they go on to say, hey, but the word sex, so right now that means it does apply. It's a form of insanity that you know, at least conservatives in the U.S. thought we had seen enough of. But here it is back.
A lot of our audience thinks back to the days of the liberals, in control of the U.S. Supreme Court and all those judicial activism decisions. Well, this one today, it rivals anything any of the liberals did back then, doesn't it?
It does. It's Bill, just in terms of how Justice Gorsuch got to this place, it's actually a violation of his own principles. But nonetheless, he got there. I mean, in one of his law school addresses, he makes very clear that what he did is exactly what the court must not do. It must not use the language in legislation to accomplish its own purposes. He said this back in 2016. He said, judges should instead strive to apply the law as it is, focusing backward, not forward, and looking to text, structure, and history to decide what a reasonable reader at the time of the events in question would have understood the law to be. Well, Justice Gorsuch, meet Justice Gorsuch, because what he did in this decision was to say that we're now going to interpret the word sex in a way that no one at the time would have meant it.
Who are these people on the Supreme Court? It seems like you can have a lot of hearings. And in my recollection, if you happen to have a jurist who lays it out there that he's sort of left of center with his opinions, they seem to be consistent, but we continue to seem to have issues with those on the more conservative side of the center, and they have a hard time sort of being, well, consistent. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, one of the things conservatives are supposed to remember, constitutional conservatives, is that we don't believe in outcome-based law. That is to say, we're not just trying to balance liberal judges who come up with their argument based upon the outcome in a case with conservative judges. We think that's the wrong way for judges to rule. And instead, we say they should adhere to the Constitution itself. But the problem for conservatives is always that conservatism in America is not an ideology. It's a set of principles and a disposition. Liberalism is an ideology. So, I mean, they have a complete set of things everybody's got to tick off. Conservatives don't. And even in the hearing process, people don't get asked some of the key questions that they should be asked. I think Justice Gorsuch, compared to others, will end up being a fairly conservative judge. But we just need to remember that judges, when they rule wrongly and leave behind their constitutional conservatism, their deference to the text, we get into huge trouble. And Neil Gorsuch will go down in history as the man that took us into this trouble.
Coming up, ideological diversity in Black America.
If we had a vaccine to get rid of anti-Black racism, let's say every bit of it is purged from every heart of America, are the principal problems facing the Black community still there? Will 70% of Black kids still be raised without fathers?
In the next segment of the Christian Outlook, stay with us. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Hi, I'm Jim Daly with Focus on the Family. The coronavirus pandemic has made life chaotic and unpredictable for everyone. It's in times like these we search for something we can truly count on. We need a true north. In the current crisis, I believe true north is loving your neighbor as yourself. And we can do that by using our time and talent and resources to help assist someone who is vulnerable or in need. And let's remember, together we'll get through this.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. On the week of May 25th, the nation witnessed the chilling and horrific video of George Floyd dying with his neck under the knee of a police officer in Minneapolis. And the country was on the same page. It was horrible. And yet, within a week, we witnessed protests and violent rioting across the nation. By June 2nd, a full 23 states had deployed National Guard troops to try to restore a measure of order. And the protests, as you well know, are continuing. Larry Elder, nationally syndicated through Salem Media, has a perspective that is gaining traction. And his film, provocatively titled Uncle Tom, is timed well for this moment. He was a guest of John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
I thought when Obama got elected in 2008, we put a fork in the notion that America is an institutionally racist nation, but apparently we have not. It's just stunning to me that so many people out in the streets yelling and screaming about what these cops did, when in fact, if you look at the data shows not only are the police not disproportionately using deadly force against black people, but there's data that suggests the cops are more hesitant, more reluctant to pull the trigger on a black suspect. It is true that a black man is 2.5 times more likely to be killed by the police than a white man. It is also true that a young black man is 8 times more likely to be a victim of a homicide than a young white man. In fact, the number one preventable cause of death for young white men is accidents, like car accidents. The number one cause of death for young black men, whether preventable or not, is homicide, almost always at the hands of another young black man. Last year, nearly 50% of the homicide victims in this country are black. Almost all of them are killed by other blacks. The rate of interracial homicide is so tiny as to almost be inconsequential. But last year, there were roughly 750 blacks killed by whites or whites killed by blacks. 500 whites were killed by blacks. 250 blacks were killed by whites. So fewer whites kill blacks, even though whites are 60% of the population, and at 13% of the population, blacks kill twice as many whites as the other way around. It's nonsense that the police are out to get black people. It is nonsense that racism remains a major problem in America. And can I say one more thing about the major problem in America part? In before he became president, Obama gave a speech at a black church. He was a senator, and he said, "My generation," which he referred to as the Joshua generation, "has to get us 10% the rest of the way there," meaning the rest of the way there in terms of getting the vision that MLK wanted to realize. He said, "The MLK generation, the Moses generation, has gotten us 90% of the way there." So 90% of the way there, 10% left to go. This is before he got elected and reelected president. For crying out loud, in 2002, there was a Fox Opinion poll that found 8% of Americans believe Elvis is still alive. So you're not going to slice into too much more of that 10% when 8% of Americans believe Elvis is still alive. Nirvana is not an option. Are there going to be individual cases where there are bad cops, even indeed racist cops? Yes. And let's deal with them on a case-by-case basis and not act as if it's a microcosm of American law enforcement in general, because that is simply a lie. And simply believing something that's false is neither here nor there if it has no unintended consequences. But this has real-world consequences. What it does is cause young black men to become much more confrontational when they're stopped by the police. I mean, after all, if you believe that the police are out to get you and they're going to do you harm, why not be confrontational? And the other thing it does is cause the cops to become more hesitant, as I mentioned, to pull back. Bad guys know it. Crime goes up, and the very victims that Black Lives Matter claims they care about are the ones who are hurt.
So whenever you see someone like George Floyd and a cop lays on his neck for 9 minutes, or a couple of weeks before that, Ahmaud Arbery, who was murdered by a shotgun wielding guys in a pickup truck. I mean, those narratives, they're there. So America shakes their head. And obviously we say, yeah, of course we see this. It's hard to refute that, isn't it, Larry?
Well, it is. It's emotional. But look at the facts. According to the Washington Post, last year there were 9 unarmed blacks shot and killed by the police. Roughly 15 unarmed blacks killed altogether, but 9 were shot and killed by the police. There were 19 whites shot and killed by the police. The number of whites shot and killed by the police exceeds the number of blacks who were unarmed, shot and killed. But nobody seems to care about that because it doesn't drive the narrative. Many people in the media believe, I think with the best of intentions, that racism remains a major problem in America. That's what they were taught by Hollywood, by academia, by the media, and the Democrat politicians know it's not true. I know that Sharpton knows it's not true. I know Jesse Jackson knows it's not true, because back in 1993, he was talking about black-on-black crime. He was lamenting it, and he even said in 1993, it's gotten to the point where when I walk down the street and I hear footsteps and I turn around and I see white people, I feel relieved. He said that back in 1993. This is what's going on right now. What's going on is the proliferation of black kids raised without fathers. That's the number one problem facing America, not racism. And forget about elder. Barack Obama once said a kid raised without a father is 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, 20 times more likely to end up in jail. It is far and away the number one problem facing this country, and we have to ask ourselves, why is it that 70% of black kids are raised without fathers, as opposed to 50% in the Hispanic community, 25% in the white community? All these numbers are high, but why is it so bad in the black community? And the answer
answer is we've incentivized women to marry the government, and we've incentivized men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility with this so-called war on poverty. And what we've done is we corrupted their incentives, and we've destroyed the black family, and we're not even having that debate.
Over the last several weeks, Kath and I have talked about 16 different people. Most, for the most part, they were pastors, theologians. Some of them were professors, but all black men. As they came on the air, we would always say, tell us a story about racism in your life. And almost to a person, they would say, I was driving while black. I got pulled over. I did nothing. But all of a sudden, I'm a suspect.
Well, John, I would say this. It's not like these things haven't been studied. In 2013, the Obama administration studied this and put out something called Race and Traffic Stops. It was done by the National Institutes of Justice, which is the research arm for the DOJ. 75% of black motorists admitted that they were pulled over for legitimate reasons. You name the offense, a black motorist was more likely to do it. I'm sorry, these are facts. And there's been something called the Police Public Contact Survey that's done every 3 years since 1996, where 60 to 70,000 Americans are asked, did you have a contact with the police in the last year? If the answer is yes, tell me about your contact. How were you spoken to? How were you addressed? Was there any physical contact? They cannot find any evidence whatsoever of some sort of pattern of institutional racism against black people. These things have been studied. I'll give you another example. Years ago, when Christy Todd Whitman was the governor of New Jersey troopers were accused of racially profiling black motorists going on the New Jersey Turnpike. She ordered a study, and it came out that the cops couldn't tell the race of the people in the car because they were driving too fast. There was sun reflection on the windshield, and at night, forget about it. You couldn't tell. So the study concluded that the cops were pulling black people over disproportionately because they were more likely to speed. The faster the speed, the more likely it was the driver was black. She didn't like the results. She threw the study out, hired new people who used brand new methodology. Same conclusion. It's not like we haven't studied these things. It's just not true. And the answer is you cannot talk about racism, the police interaction with black people without talking about black criminality, which nobody wants to talk about.
Listen, Larry, I've listened to you for years. I get that. I totally respect you. I love your show. I mean, you're talking about your people, but I feel like, you know, I'm a white woman. I feel like you're letting white people off the hook a little. What do you say?
Well, I say that if we had a vaccine to get rid of white racism, anti-black racism, let's say every bit of it is purged for every heart of America, are the principal problems facing the black community still there? Do we still have a 50% dropout rate in our inner city high schools with nearly all of the ones who do in fact graduate unable to read, write, and compute at grade level? Will 70% of black kids still be raised without fathers? Will 25% of young black boys still have criminal records living in the inner city, either having been arrested in jail, on parole, or on probation? If the answer is yes to all these questions, then the eradication of racism is not the problem, and it's not the solution. The solution is we've got to change the behavior of people in this country.
Coming up, re-enchanting humanity.
Fundamentally, we will not know who we are as human beings unless we go to God's definition of the human race.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, you've seen how your freedom's under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. As we look at the state of affairs in our culture today, we see widespread abortion on demand and confusion on what is meant by the word sex and male and female. And yes, so much tension around issues of race. At the root of all of these things is a confusion of what it means to be human, made in God's image, full of dignity, worthy of value from conception until natural death. What the church needs and what the culture needs is captured well in the title of the new book by our next guest, Reenchanting Humanity. The volume is by the young theologian Owen Strand. He was a guest of Eric Metaxas.
This is the question of our time. Mm-hmm. Who are we? And you are making a theological case. Why a theological case?
I'm making a theological case. The other dimensions matter of humanity, but I'm making it because fundamentally we will not know who we are as human beings unless we go to God's definition of the human race. So we recognize that he makes humanity on the sixth day, the sixth day of creation, and he makes us in his image and likeness. If you don't start there, Eric, I don't know how you're going to rediscover who humanity is. You're going to end up defining humanity by our feelings, by our background, by our skin color, by all sorts of things. And those things matter in different ways, but they're not first and foremost what we want to say humanity is. We're the special creation of Almighty God. We want to start there.
When you talk about re-enchanting humanity, I guess one of my questions that I want to ask you, and I'll ask you now, is why do you say re-enchanting humanity? Because it's, for me, it's a worldview issue. Mm-hmm. It touches on a lot. But why do you talk about enchantment? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I was reading the works of the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor in preparation for this book, and he used the term enchantment. And he was talking about it in reference to secularism and how secularism has really taken the light out of our eyes. And so I kind of lifted the concept, if you will, from Mr. Taylor, thanks to him, and brought it back into my understanding of the Christian worldview. And what I'm after here is I'm trying to say we're not just an evolved animal. Again, we're not just a clump of cells. We're not a blank slate in the 18th century philosophical understanding. You've got movements like the Enlightenment. You know, we could do a deep dive on these kind of things. But very quickly, a figure like John Locke is someone who says, famously defines humanity as a blank slate. Fast forward about 220 years to our time, Eric, and you've got lots of people basically believing that they're a blank slate. In other words, that they create their own identity. They frequently look to their feelings, their inmost desires, to define what that slate is going to look like. What I'm trying to say is God gave us feelings. He gave us affections. It's not bad to feel. He wants us to feel after him. But we're not going to understand who we are, and we're not going to grasp the full dignity and worth and beauty of the human race unless we know that God made us in his image and has given us a script to live out as men and women and Christians in this world as those who give him conscious glory as we make our way on the earth. That's what I'm after.
Throughout history, human beings, whether they subscribe to the biblical narrative or don't, have known that we are something beyond creatures that just live and die, that there is something special, that there is something that even if we don't know what it is and even if we can't put our finger on it, that it's there. You're saying, I'm gathering, that the Enlightenment and the last couple of centuries have sucked that out of us. And that we have become people who define ourselves largely in the culture as soulless. We don't talk about the soul. We're just, you know, I need food, drink, vodka, and something over my head. It's like what the communists used to reduce people to. You're just a creature,
right?
And you get bread, vodka, and an ugly building, and a crummy job, and you should be satisfied. And you think, well, wait a minute, but the soul is not satisfied. I am crushed unless I have. And so when you say re-enchanting humanity, it seems to me that you're trying to help people capture that once more. That's kind of at the heart of what you're saying.
It is. Let's make the soul great again, if you will. I mean, really, really, we've got to understand that we are not just a body. Actually, God made the body.
Right.
So God loves the body. Christians are those who should love the body and should make a case for that in public and that
right.
sort of thing. And yet, we recognize that we have a soul in order that we would know God. The Enlightenment, Hume, Kant, and others several hundred years ago, basically, if we reduce their arguments, they claim that unless you can prove something empirically,
right.
unless you can, you know, put it in a test tube and verify it,
right.
then you can't really believe in it. I mean,
right.
you can have your precious moments, your special quiet times. That's great for you, but that's not provable. And
right.
that's really a scientific worldview, which you've done so much to critique. Very thankful for that. We've got to make very clear as Christians today that we have a soul and that that soul is given us specially so that we would commune with the living God. It's not an accident. It's not this thing we're embarrassed about. Lots of people around us are living as robots and materialists, and it
yeah.
doesn't work.
Coming up,
I think your average young guy today would not know exactly what it means that he is a man.
More on reenchanting humanity when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy.
They're preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. As we watch the unfolding sexual revolution, the Christian today is being pressed to answer questions that had just been instinctive and intuitive for generations past. Questions like, what is a man? And what is a woman? The pressure today is to say that these realities are fluid. That is, they can change. They are a state of mind and subject to self-perception. That's why Owen Strand's work on re-enchanting humanity is so strategic and so necessary. Let's pick up on Owen's conversation with Eric Metaxas.
For whom did you write this book? Is it overly theological, or is it something that a more mainstream reader could tackle?
So it is theological. I wrote it for the church primarily to instruct people in what it means to be made in the image of God, what it means that we're sinners, that's chapter 2, why we do work on the earth, that's chapter 3, what it means to be a man or a woman. That's an area of tremendous confusion today, as you well know, Eric, with all sorts of people not being sure about what it means to be a boy or a girl. You've got boys entering girl track meets and these sorts of things. I mean, it's just happening like crazy. You've got typically boys entering the girls' restroom in public schools and public areas. So that's another major section of this book, because people, again, you stop somebody on the street out here in New York City, people do not necessarily know how to define manhood or womanhood.
Oh, that's an understatement. I mean, yeah. These concepts have fallen on hard times, but it's like this is a real crisis right now. And it's been the case roughly for the last 50 years. I mean, the intellectual roots go back far, but it's come into the popular culture really in the last 50 or so years.
Yes.
And it strikes me that, you know, the Bible is pretty clear on this kind of thing.
Yeah, so you start with the scripture, you go to Genesis 2, and you recognize that the Lord creates Adam from the dust of the ground, Genesis 2, 7, and then he calls him in Genesis 2, 15 to work the ground of Eden and to watch over or keep the garden. And so right there off the bat, you've got protection, you've got provision there put on the man's shoulders, and then the woman is created from his rib, and he's called to hold fast to her, so he's called to lead his wife. This never means, of course, abusively lead her or something like this. It's going to be defined, this leadership, in Ephesians 5, in terms of Jesus Christ, who lays his life down for his bride, his wife, if you will. And so men are called in Scripture to be self-sacrificial, to put women and children before them, to be hard workers, to be those who protect, to be those who provide. But as you just referenced, our culture has lost sight of those kind of roles, those callings for a man.
Yeah.
So young men, really, if you polled them,
yeah,
I think your average young guy today would not know exactly what it means that he is a man.
Right. And it's such a basic idea. I mean, it doesn't get more basic that we need to know these things. We can hardly function in the world if we don't know these things. And I do think it's why we have such social breakdown. Because
yes,
if a man doesn't know what it is to be a man and a husband and a father and how to lead in a loving way, in a self-sacrificial way, the way Christ commands us to do,
yeah,
he will be lost, and he will attract to himself a woman who is similarly lost. It's almost ironic that she's complementarily lost, you know, that
right,
you have this double confusion, and, you know, women are trying to lead. And everybody knows, like, when you're dancing, the man is supposed to lead. It doesn't mean he's a better dancer. He could be a much worse dancer, but the rules, kind of like in baseball, the man leads. And so it's the woman's job to follow, even if he's leading not so well, not to lead. Is that, and we're living in a culture right now where that makes people's heads explode. They cannot get that.
Yes.
And it's offensive. And they're hearing all the wrong things.
They are. You know, and there's all sorts of messages given to women today. It's really a feminist age and a feminist culture. The Bible has an enchanted vision of womanhood, I would argue. When a woman trusts Christ and knows Christ as her Savior, she understands there's all sorts of things that God calls her to do in Christ. We understand that the roles of mother, the role of wife, the role of homemaker, the role of those who raise children in different ways, these are God-glorifying roles in the Bible. Our culture may sneer at them.
Oh, I mean, they're sacred, and yeah, you're quite right that the culture sneers at them. Why did you feel the need, Owen, to write this now? In other words, it strikes me that most people in the church would know or would agree with what you're saying here? Is the main point of this to articulate it?
I think people today feel tremendous pressure from a secularizing and neo-pagan culture, really. In other words, people today do not know what it means to be human. Christians, of course, have a basic idea, but we're in such an oppositional moment. We understand that many people around us draft off of secularism to understand human origins. So there was a cosmic Big Bang, right? And we're just evolved matter, basically.
Yeah.
And then they go to neo-paganism, I argue in this book, by which I mean an understanding that we're kind of little gods and there's no real order to humanity and there's no script for our sexuality. Our body is kind of just the vessel of our desires, so we can do with it what we want. Eric, what I see is that a lot of Christians are falling prey to these kind of views. You have gay Christianity now cropping up in evangelical circles, transgender Christianity cropping up. So what I'm trying to do is just call Christians back to the richness of biblical doctrine on these matters and say, we don't need to fear the culture on these counts. We have a beautiful vision of humanity that I actually think is going to be evangelistic if we will just share it with people and call them back to who God made us to be.
I agree with that. It's interesting, you know, when you talk about the Big Bang and stuff, it's funny because one of the principal proponents in the last decades of this scientistic, materialistic worldview was Carl Sagan, who's no longer with us. But I remember him saying in these kind of dramatic tones that the universe is all there is and all that's ever been, and we are made of the same stuff that the stars are made of, right? And I thought to myself, he's basically lying, not just because he's getting it factually correct, but there's hypocrisy because he's trying to put English on the ball and make it sound romantic and beautiful.
Yeah.
And he says, we are made of the same stuff that the stars are made of. And I thought to myself, wait a second. When you say star, you don't mean something beautiful.
Yeah.
You mean flaming ball of gas. And so he kind of spins it to make it sound kind of beautiful and romantic and whatever. But what he's actually saying is, no. There's nothing. But he's almost trying to celebrate the nothing in a way that contradicts precisely what he is saying about who we are and what the stars are. And I feel like there's this religious impulse in people that you can never escape it. They're always going to try to, you know, square the circle. They cannot bear the bleakness of what they're saying.
Right.
So they somehow have to turn it into a religion that calls itself atheism or something. But meaning and purpose are so baked into who we are that even when you are anti-meaning and anti-purpose, you find yourself falling nonetheless into that kind of language.
Coming up, a few more minutes on reenchanting humanity.
You need to earn your value. You need to show that you contribute to the society. That's a theory of extrinsic worth. That's what our culture believes.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. The pressure by the culture today, including pressure from virtually all of today's elite media outlets, is to conform, to yield to the new categories, the new normal. And the call of the Christian is to push back. Yes, all of our interactions should be marked with grace, but our understanding of what it means to be human should be faithful to Scripture. Once again, Owen Strand's visit with Eric Metaxas.
When somebody says that we evolved out of the primordial soup through random mutations and accident, it follows logically, there's no escape, that life is meaningless. So when you start talking about, well, we create our own meaning or whatever, why? Tell me why you're even talking about meaning.
Yeah, and what flows out of that, I talk about this a little bit in the book, is a concept of extrinsic worth or extrinsic value. In other words, you need to earn your value. You need to show that you contribute to the society. You think of how in the UK, for example, there was a TV program a year ago where the host took a person with Down syndrome around and tabulated as the show went on just how costly this person's life, this disabled person's life was. And it added up to something like $12 million for a single person with Down syndrome, something astronomical. And the clear implication of the show was, you're costing us more than you're contributing. Well, guess what? That's a theory of extrinsic worth. That's what our culture believes.
That is word for word almost what the Nazis were preaching.
Yes.
Lives unworthy of life.
Yes.
And it is exactly what you say. It's extrinsic worth that you have no inherent value, no intrinsic value. Mm-hmm. And so now we're going to judge you mm-hmm. on what you do, what you contribute. If you're lying in bed and, you know, taking up the time and energy and the food order that could be used to ship to the soldiers at the front,
right.
we're going to euthanize you and we're going to ship the ashes home to your parents.
Yes.
That's literally what was happening. And you're telling me that now in the UK,
yes.
they are explicitly talking this way.
Right. And you think about 60 million babies aborted in America, this supposedly first world civilization. You recognize we need to recover the Christian doctrine of the image of God because it teaches us intrinsic value. It teaches us that the child with Down syndrome has infinite worth and infinite dignity and doesn't have to prove anything about that to be valued and treasured. We need to recover that kind of conception of the human person.
That's beautiful. It seems to me, Owen, that this would be a great book for pastors or spiritual leaders because, as you were saying, there are a lot of pastors, a lot of people in ministry themselves who don't get this stuff. They've kind of gotten pushed sideways by the culture.
Yeah, I don't think necessarily most pastors would deny the kind of things we're talking about, but we all feel such heat for holding these kind of views, these kind of principles, that I'm trying to do my small part with Reenchanting Humanity to strengthen pastors, to strengthen leaders, to strengthen lay Christians who love the Lord and want to stand for the truth in a fallen world. And so this book is aimed at shoring up your understanding of what God made humanity to be, a thing we really need to give attention to today.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Catch this entire conversation between Owen and Eric at ChristianOutlook.com. And while you're there, take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posian and Michael Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.